Hi, wrestling fans. This is Sunny Beach, and you're listening to Wrestling Nostalgia.
This is Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty. Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining us, and here we are, ladies and gentlemen. It looks like we are back weekly. Hopefully, you're as pleased with that as I am. I did tell you last episode with the streamlining of my podcast world, doing away with the This Is Extreme ECW podcast to focus primarily on this would enable me to make this once again weekly. And I'm very excited by that because, like I said last time, the format of this allows me to speak to a wider array of wrestlers. So it's you know, not that I didn't enjoy This Is Extreme podcast. I did. And like I said, I will still speak to ECW talent. But I do like this where the door's wide open for the opportunities that come to talk to different guys. Much like today, which my guest today is Sunny Beach, probably most known for his time in the UWF. He also appeared in Global, the AWF, did some work at WWE. He's been all over. He's been to Japan. He's been here, there, and everywhere. Done a little bit of everything. And we talk to him and talk all about that coming up here in a bit. You know, I've got a lot of reflecting going here lately because, you know, we've lost some wrestlers here lately, right? We've lost Ole Anderson. We lost Virgil not too long ago. We lost Butcher Vachon. You know, lots of different people. Today, as I'm recording this, it is March 19th. And today would have been Larry Keane's, let's see, what would we got here? Ooh, his 64th birthday, if I'm doing the math correctly there, and I think I am. Larry Keane, obviously known to most probably as Cousin Jr. in the WWE, also did a run in Memphis as Moondog Cujo, but he's most known to me for his run in the WWA as King Harley Hogg, one of the Wild Hogs. One of my favorites when I was younger, and still watching Bruiser up into the 80s. The Hogs, the Wild Hogs were great, man. They were fun. They were wild. And just a blast to watch. Did some really cool stuff. You know, very rough and tough. Very reminiscent of the Moondogs. So it fit in when he became a Moondog. And Harley also had, I think he did some spots in Memphis and around different places. But like I said, to me, most remembered for being Harley Hogg in the WWA. You know, it's just... And it always makes me think, you know, when I talk about, you know, these guys that we lost recently and remembering Lanny on the, you know, what would have been his birthday. And, you know, and I post lots of things, right? I post lots of birthdays for guys who have passed on. And it always, you know, it always causes me to reflect and think, man, we're losing generations of these wrestlers and there's not many left. And I mean, recently, you know, Bob Ellis had a birthday and, you know, he's, I believe, got to be the oldest, you know, living former active wrestler there is, and who knows what will happen there. But so I guess my point is let's appreciate these guys while they're still alive. Let's support them while they're still alive, right? A lot of them still do convention appearances. A lot of them still go out to shows and do signings and different things. A lot of them still sell some merchandise online. And you know, and I'm always trying to reach out to a lot of these guys and get them on here to tell her story. You know, a couple years back, I got to interview Larry Henning, and literally just right before, you know, he passed away, and it was an honor to speak to Larry anyway. But man, it was really just kind of touching and moving to be one of the last interviews he did. I think he did do one more interview after me, I believe. I could be wrong, but I was one of the last couple interviews he did in his life, and it's you know, and that's I like that, man. That's important to me. To get these guys out there to share their stories. So if, you know, if you get the opportunity, don't say, I'll catch them next time. Cause man, you never know. You never know if there is a next time. So get out there and support these guys and tell them what their careers meant to you while they're still alive to appreciate your comments. So, but anyway, I don't mean to kind of start in a somber tone, but you know, like I said, it seems like the old adage is, holds true a lot in wrestling. It seems like we lose them in threes. It seems like, and we got hit with that, the latest three, and it's just, it's you know, it makes you pause, and at least it always does me. So, but speaking of pause, let's take a quick break. And like I mentioned earlier, when we come back, we'll have the interview with Sunny Beach. So stick around.
If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number two, and Screams.
And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm being joined by Sunny Beach. Sunny, how are you?
Great, Dave. How are you?
I am doing good. Let's jump right into it. From what I can gather, you broke into wrestling in Florida, correct? And you trained with Jimmy Del Rey, who was Jimmy Backlund at that time.
Jimmy Backlund was in our camp. A guy named Mike Thor, Mike Prather, he was down in Jacksonville. We had Hallie Wilson, one of the Smurfs, and Crusher Knopf. Rick Knopf was down there. Larry Hamilton. He worked a lot in championship wrestling from Florida and continental wrestling and Alabama and some Georgia championships. So these guys, you know, I broke in with a really good crew down there.
Yeah, sounds like it. I was very curious. You played a small role in the movie No Holds Barred. How did you get cast for that?
I'm still asking that question. I was in Peach State Wrestling and Southern Championship for Jerry Blackwell at the time. Uh-huh. And I guess they liked my look, and Pat Patterson called me up out of nowhere and said, hey, we like your look. We'd like you to be in the movie. We're doing a feature film with Hulk Hogan and shooting in Atlanta next month. We'd like you to be in a big fight scene for us to, you know, a plot point in the movie to set the movie, the tone of the movie. I said, I'd love to. Who you got me working with? He goes, Joe LeDuc. I said, wow, I've always loved him as a heel. I said, I'd love to, you know, work with Joe. So they flew me up first class at Delta Airlines to Atlanta, and the rest is history. They started me right away with the WWF after I finished filming, and I got my booking sheet, and away we went. So that was the summer of 1988, and I stayed with WWF to about 92 on and off.
Yeah, so the working for WWF, that spun out of the No Holds Barred thing?
Yeah, they offered me a contract, and a two-year deal. I got on board with them, and you know, the older boys took a liking to me, and you know, I made a lot of good friends there. I traveled a lot with the Conquistadors, Nikolai Volkoff, Boris Zukov. I was predominantly a heel with the WWF, Hercules Hernandez, Tonga, Haku. I'd rode with those guys a lot, Barry Horowitz. You know, I traveled with Mike Sharp. So, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, seasoned veterans, Greg Valentine, I rode with him a lot. So, you know, I made some great friends with the WWE and WWF that, you know, I'm still with friends with today. Stan Hansen from the movie No Holds Barred, he got me booked in All Japan Pro Wrestling, and he's actually coming to stay with me in May. We're doing a couple autograph shows up here in New York and New Jersey. So I've kept, you know, I've got lifelong friends in the business, you know, that I kept relationships with.
Yeah, very, just on a side note, you mentioned Mike Sharp. Are the stories true about Mike Sharp that he was a compulsive showerer?
He was the cleanest man in the wrestling. Yes. And he was the last one to usually leave the shower at the locker room. And he was a little quirky, but, you know, in a good way. You know, he was clean. He wasn't dirty. So he took time, and he washed and he bathed and he kept his clothes clean and neat. And, just a respectful guy, you know.
Yeah. Sure, everybody that worked with him appreciated that. We're all quirky in our own ways, though. So we all got our things.
There's some don't wash their, you know, tights and stuff for weeks on end.
I know.
It's like that I wrestle with. And, you know, you got to tell them, hey, please.
For all of us. Come on.
The referee, everybody was dying, you know, on the way to the ring. You know, he was like Pigpen from the Peanuts, you know. The ring.
Yeah. Around 89, you worked some for Stampede. Did that come through working with the Bulldogs and WWF?
Yeah, it actually did. And Owen Hart, Owen was a good friend of mine, God rest his soul. And he got me booked up there with Stampede. And Tommy Boeington, British Bulldog, was good, the booker. And, you know, I met them through WWE and everything. And I was there the night that Rougeau that knocked Tommy's teeth out at TV taping. And I gave him the shirt off my back to go to the hospital in. And, you know, he was bleeding and, you know, I didn't have a shirt. He was like walking down the hallway with Pat Patterson drinking a cup of coffee. And all of a sudden, boom, you know, he got hit out of nowhere. And Bad News Allen was there. He saw the whole thing. And another guy that passed away way too soon. And myself, there was only like three or four of us that saw the whole thing happen. And I was one of them, but I wasn't a stooge. I wasn't stooging on anybody. But, you know, I didn't know the whole infighting with the Bulldogs and the Rougeaus, so I don't get involved. I'm in my own business. So, But, you know, that's why I'm liked by everybody in the business. So, I stay neutral and I don't get involved. And, you know, I'm a friend to all that want me to be their friend. And if you're an asshole to me, then I don't bother with you. So, you know, that's the way I sit. You know, people nice to me, I'm nicer to them. But people act like a jerk or, you know, don't treat you right, then I don't bother with them.
Yeah. That,
rules to live by.
Yeah, that's right. That 89, around that time, at Stampede stuff, I think that's very underappreciated. When the Bulldogs were up there, Morocco was up there, Pelman and Bruce Hart.
Boondog was up there. Yeah. The Power were up there. Larry Cameron. Who else was up there? Mike Shaw, Bastion Booger.
Yeah, Matt Mockensen.
Call himself. Yeah. Then we had Steve Blackman was there, Beef Wellington. Yeah. Chris Benoit. I wrestled him for a Cruiserweight Championship up in Edmonton, his hometown. Back when I was with Stampede, we had a great match. I was going to get a nice push up, then they were going to put me with Brian Pillman. He was coming back up there, but that kind of got squashed. You know, the paydays weren't that great up there. And, you know, I promised one payday and got another. And the vans kept broken down and it was freezing up there. And a good old Florida surfer boy, he had no business being out in the wintertime like that and 30, 40 degrees below zero. And Red Hook, Saskatchewan, Edmonton, you know, Calgary, you got 3 feet of snow. And I went up there and I didn't even have a winter jacket. And the first thing I did was find a department store and I got some, you know, about 3 pairs of long johns and wool socks. And, you know, I definitely spent my first week's pay on winter clothes up there to try to stay warm. And they had me staying in this place, the York Hotel. And downstairs was a strip club. And, you know, being I got Bucky Siegler from Georgia. We went up to Stampede together up there and we were rooming up there together. And it was just, I think it was like $400 a week for the hotel room. But, you know, sometimes you were staying, you know, out on the road or the van would break down. You have to sleep in the van or Trailways bus or Greyhound bus. You know, it was ridiculous up there. So I only really stayed about 6 weeks up there.
Yeah, and then, like you said, you went back to WWE for a while, and then they started calling you Sandy Beach.
I was Sandy Beach, but then a DJ down in Florida had the name trademarked as a DJ entertainer.
Okay. And
he being on TV was hurting his, you know, good name down in Florida on the DJ circuit. But he was like a DJ slash MC slash wannabe bodybuilder slash all kinds of, you know, he had about 30 or 40 different trades, and he was a master of none, you know, and he even tried to wrestle, I heard, and they kicked his butt and he didn't make it. So, and you know, at first, you know, people were going, "You're not Sandy Beach. We know a guy, Sandy Beach, down in Tampa. He's a juice head," you know? And I'm like, "No, that's not me," but I'm using a name as, you know, being from Jacksonville, Florida. And I was always at the beach, and I actually knew the guy when he was in Florida, but he was a bouncer. He wasn't a DJ yet, or he wasn't a bodybuilder. He was up and coming, you know, weightlifter. And he was, you know, he had good size to him and stuff, but he was just roided out and he wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. So he didn't really amount to much in the business or whatever he did in life.
Yeah. So because of him, then that's when you shifted over to Sunny Beach.
I got a cease and desist order and WWF said they didn't want any lawsuits. So just name and, you know, and I just changed into Sunny, you know, and I was Sunny before Tammy Fetch, you know, but you know, she got the bigger push in more ways than I did.
She had a little more going for it maybe than you did, Sonny. I think no offense. not recent times notwithstanding, but
well, I'm out and, you know, like, I guess I'm out here in the world being a positive influence to people, and she's behind bars doing time.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, glory she had, I'm sure she would trade it in for a couple, you know, her freedom right now.
Yep, I venture so.
But, you know, I don't add on nobody, so I feel sorry for her. I saw her a couple of years ago at an autograph show down in Jersey, and a guy named Tommy Fierro was doing a couple of shows, and he actually inducted me and a couple other guys, Mike Kalua, and who else was it? Ray Odyssey, and I think it was Tommy Cairo into the Independent Hall of Fame down there for his wrestling group down in Jersey. And he's doing like wrestle cons and all that stuff. 80s.
Yeah. WrestleCon. Yeah. The 80s wrestle cons. Yeah. Wait, you mentioned Ray Odyssey. Did you and Ray ever do anything? Have any matches, tag team or anything? Cause he did a surfer thing too.
We never tagged. We never had any matches. He was working with the Savoldis a little bit. And I think he worked a little bit with ECW, but I never got to wrestle with Ray. And, Ray was a lot smaller than me too. I mean, I was probably 80 pounds heavier than Ray.
Yeah, well, one of the things you might be most known for is your time in the UWF. You were one of their top attractions, everything. How did you get to working for Herb Abrams in the UWF?
Well, the funny thing is John Arizzi, close friend of mine from Long Island, he used to do all these conventions and stuff, and he had Pro Wrestling Spotlight talk show. Mm-hmm. And when I was feuding with Mick Foley up and down the East Coast on the independent scene and stuff, he was good friends with a lady named Georgia Ann Macropoulos. She was had her own wrestling chatterbox newsletter. Yep. She was very good friends with Bruno Sammartino and you know, a bunch of the older wrestlers from the 50s and 60s. You know, she's been going since she was a little girl in her 50s. So she, you know, knew all them. And Bruno took a liking to me, and he introduced me, you know, John Arizzi and everybody. And I knew Bruno, you know, from growing up and my short time with the WWF over there when I, you know, met him there. He was, you know, sometimes like if we were in Pittsburgh or something or close by, he would come to shows and stuff. But him and Vince weren't getting along back then. But as long as Vince wasn't there, he'd come pop by, say hello to the boys and stuff. But or we'd meet, you know, somewhere for drinks afterwards or a dinner or something. But Bruno always liked me. I always had a great, you know, he kind of like mentored me, you know, and he was very approachable. And he would tell me, you know, what I did right in the ring, what I did wrong, how I could do things better. And I respected his judgment and, you know, his input in my matches and stuff like that. So I got in through Bruno with the UWF through an introduction to Herb Abrams through Georgia Metropolis and through John Arizzi. And Herb wanted to make his own stars in the UWF that weren't really pushed in other promotions, like the Power Twins. He pushed them, the Blackhearts, Dave Heath, and Tom Nash, you know, and managed by Luna back then. Bam Bam Bigelow, Steve Williams. He brought in a bunch of great supporting cast members, Don Morocco. He got all the guys. Everybody from WWF was leaving. I mean, he even had Andre at a couple of TV tapings. Captain Lou brought credibility. You know, we had John Tolis. So, I mean, Brian Blair, Jim Brunzel. We had the girls, Wendy Richter, and a ton of, you know, top-notch talent. Beach Brawl, he had Ivan Koloff and Bob Backlund. I mean, that could have sold out any arena back in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you know. So, I mean, he, you know, they were a little bit past their prime, but, you know, it was like a Legends match and people wanted to see it. So, and they both worked their butts off and, you know, they were excellent. And, you know, just having those guys on the card with us was like, you know, like a blessing, you know, to help draw. And it just, you know, Herb, he had his own demons, you know, he was into partying and, you know, doing his own thing, but he used a lot of his money too to do the promotion. If he had more money and more investors and he had the right people around him, I think the UWF could have been, you know, kind of like AEW is today, but he didn't have AEW money or anything like that. Yeah. That is, and he had money from Sports Channel America and a couple of other promotions, you know, when he would sell his, you know, tapes or overseas, or, you know, he would make money and he would try to, you know, keep everything going. And, you know, Blackjack Rome, we did stuff at MGM Grand at one pay-per-view, and, you know, he just didn't promote it. All he wanted to do was party. It was one big party to him. And it was like he wanted to put on his own matches he wanted to see or be part of. So he was like a fan living out his fantasies, you know, with a big promotion. So that's why it didn't really take off, to be honest with you. But we had a lot of good times. And he you know, was trying to build me up pretty good. You know, I was his MGM champion out there and TV champion. And then me and Steve Ray were tag team champions as Wet n' Wild.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, you talk about Herb. I believe you were on the dark side of the ring about Herb, weren't you?
Yeah. They called me up, and I got in touch with me and Herb's first cousin, Steve Simon, are very good friends, and we owned a couple of horses together and stuff in the thoroughbred business. So we're trying to, you know. Excuse me, one second.
That's okay.
You know, it was, you know, I got those guys together with Dark Side of the Ring, and I got some Steve Ray together and some of the other guys, you know, to speak about Herb and stuff, and Mick Foley and Brian Blair and a bunch of the other guys, Colonel Red and everybody, you know, said what was on their mind about him and, you know, what they went through. And, you know, most of the guys like Bam Bam and Steve Williams and Paul Orndorff, you know, they all passed away. And, you know, it's sad, you know, that a lot of his main talent with the UWF was gone. Captain Lou, Tolis, Bruno. So,
yeah,
you know, it was good when it lasted. You know, we had a good time and got a lot of good memories out of it.
Yeah, and you mentioned Steve Ray. Like I said, you and him teamed as Wet n' Wild, and you guys were really over, really popular, especially, you know, with the kids and the younger fans and everything else. What did you think of your time of teaming with Steve? Did you enjoy being part of a tag team?
Yeah, it wasn't bad. I mean, I enjoyed, you know, just working, you know, just staying busy, staying relevant was, you know, really good. You know, I think he would have had, we had more time together to gel. Steve lived out in Kansas City and I live here in Long Island, New York. So it was hard for us to get together, and we didn't really spend too much time in a gym together. If we would have done that and worked on some of our moves and some of our timing and teamwork, I think we could have, you know, really went to some places. I mean, Kevin Sullivan liked us and he wanted to, you know, book me when he was booking down in, you know, we went on a couple of overseas trips with Kevin, and when he was married with Nancy and stuff, to the Philippines and Singapore, and went to Venezuela and stuff with John Arizzi when he was promoting the World Wrestling Superstars and all that stuff. And we had some really good matches, but, you know, he wanted us to maybe go to WCW, and we actually got booked, and Herb put a squash to this, to Global Championship Wrestling down in Dallas.
Yeah.
We got booked for their tag team down there as Wet and Wild, and Herb called up, and we didn't have I didn't have a signed contract with Herb. I don't think anybody did, because Herb never did anything, you know, really by the books or anything. He just, you know, flew by the skin of his teeth, you know, but I never had a signed contract. And he called up down there to ESPN and telling him that we were in breach of our contract, that we can't wrestle for anybody, that he has exclusive with us, which he didn't, because I was still doing independence and doing my own thing. And I was even promoting my own shows. So he tried to put a kibosh to that. And I was good friends with Joe Pedicino down there, and he's the one that got me booked down there with Global. He called me up, he goes, could you guys work? I said, yeah, we're not signed to nothing.
Yeah.
So we went down there, and then they had to take us off TV.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Global. So you did go down and work for them, but yeah, you never got to make the show.
Like matches, they put us over on one match, and then I worked against, I think, the Renegade Warriors, the Young Bloods, and I put a hood on. Because, you know, while we were filming, Herb was calling and busting chops and making problems. You know, it was ridiculous. But, you know, it just goes to show, you know, that, you know, when you're in demand or, you know, somebody wants you, you know, people do anything to stop you from making a living. And I was very close with Herb, but he should have never done that.
Yeah. Yeah. Global was really hot. And I think now when you look back in retrospect, man, they were doing a lot of things ahead of their time. I mean, with, you know, Jerry Lynn and the Lightning Kid and different things going on in Global, they were
Kid, Lightning Kid, and then they had Buff Bagwell, a handsome strange, you know, the Patriot, you know, Del Wilkes was down there, and
Harlem Heat guys were down there, weren't they?
Harlem Heat, they had, who else was down there? Renegade Warriors, the Young Bloods. I mean, they had great talent. I think Jack Victory and
didn't Ahmed Johnson work for him some?
Might have been.
Moabed, or however he was called.
He was probably down there too, but they had a lot of, you know, the world class guys down there.
Yeah.
Chaz, whatever his name was down there, Tugboat Tyler.
Chaz Tyler.
So they had some great talent down there. And I mean, Global, I mean, they had that hot market, you know, after AWA went off the air, Global was the next thing on ESPN.
Yeah.
And they could have really, really, you know, blew the roof off with that. And, you know, but they stayed regional, and Gordon Solie and Joe Pedicino had that, I think it was called Pro Wrestling This Week, where they would take, you know, back then the territories were still around, and they would, you know, take clips from Global, World Class, you know, AWA, Championship Wrestling from Florida, Portland, you know, they would just mix all these tapes, even Puerto Rico and Japan. So, you know, that's how I got involved with them, through Joe Pedicino, and I was with Southern Championship, because Joe was doing a lot of commentary and play-by-play, him and his wife Bonnie Blackstone. So I got to be, you know, in a lot of good territories before the end of the territories. So, you know, with Global, and, you know, I was out in, you know, Stampede, and I started out down in Tampa and then Georgia, and, you know, for Jerry Blackwell, and going overseas a couple of times. I went to Puerto Rico and ran opposition to Carlos Colon with Hercules Ayala and Matt Fernandez and a bunch of those guys, TNT, Juan Rivera, you know, and El Perez. So I mean, the super medics, the Estradas were down there. So I mean, and you know, I got to hang out with them, and you know, I was with them with the WWF. So you know, I made some really lifelong friendships, and I still talk to Estrada and them, Jose, you know, and Jose Luis Rivera. So yeah. I'm very close with those guys.
Yeah, you also work for the AWF, which was another hot, it kind of short-lived startup promotion, and you also booked for them early on, right?
Well, Goran Skasari, he was getting Eddie Gilbert to be his booker, and I was trying to get some of the New York talent for him, and I was trying to help him. He inherited a lot of money. Both his parents passed away, and he was a big Mark wrestling fan, and he wouldn't listen to anybody but himself. He wanted me to book Sabu and this one and that one.
He wanted me to fly in a bunch of people. And he, you know, he was a big fan. He wanted to see his own matches too. So I did a show on Staten Island and I booked Sabu because Gordon asked me to do him a favor. He wanted to see Sabu. So I booked him. And that was one of the best things I ever did. I didn't know too much about Sabu. He was first coming out. I think he wrestled his first match in New York for me, if I'm not mistaken, at the Jewish Community Center. And some promoter named Tommy D, they called in a bomb threat on me because I sold the place out. It was like we had almost 2,000 people there at this Jewish Community Center. And my first match, I think it was me and Mick Foley. We wrestled the main event out there. And then I think Sabu, I forgot who he wrestled, but I know I had the Power Twins on the show. I had Skull Von Crush against Barry Horowitz, a German versus a Jew at a Jewish center. Can you believe that? I had to put Barry, we had to put Barry over. I think we had Mike Sharp out there, Jose Luis Rivera, the Conquistadors were there. I think they wrestled the Power Twins. And I think Lanny Poffo might have been on that card too. So, I mean, it was almost like a WWF show, you know. And then the second time I promoted the same venue, I had me and Paul Orndorff wrestled the Kamalas, 1 and 2, Ben Peacock and James Harris. Mm-hmm. And then we had the Haiti Kid as Kamala 3, Cheap Too Lolo. So, you know, I booked some pretty good shows and I had some pretty good talent. Everybody enjoyed themselves. Everybody got paid and we all made some money.
Yeah. But you end up having a falling out with Gordon. So what happened there with him?
Well, I had a falling out with Gordon because he wasn't listening to anybody. And I said, look, Gordon, I'm not going to help you waste all your money. I said, I'm not doing it. I said, and then he goes, well, you cost me all this money. I said, I didn't cost you anything. You booked Eddie Gilbert and all these guys. You're guaranteeing them top dollar when you're paying guys $4,000 or $5,000. You want to pay me $1,000 and I'm doing all the work trying to help you book. And I said, I don't mind helping you. I said, but you know, you're paying these guys for one shot coming in and out and they're not worth it. And you're giving them all this money and I'm working with you every day and you're not paying me nothing, $1,000 for a shot. And, you know, so I told him, look, I can't work for that. I'm sorry. I got a family. So that the only falling out I had with Gordon was because he didn't listen to anybody. He wanted to do his own thing. And he was like a know-it-all. You know, he was like a computer nerdy kid. I mean, God rest his soul. I know he passed away and everything. And he was a sick kid too. I mean, and his parents left him a lot of money and he went through that money real quick. And he shouldn't have done that. I mean, he hired all these production company people and he ordered all these big banners and stuff. And he thought he was going to be the next big thing. But I don't know what type of money he had or his resources or anything. But you know, his parents, you know, they were well off and he lived in, you know, downtown Brooklyn. He had a nice condo there that was paid off and everything. But I just, you know, after I couldn't help him anymore and I just, you know, got tired of, you know, trying to listen to his nonsense and he just didn't make any sense. And I said, look, Gordon, I can't help you anymore.
Yeah.
I'm just doing my own thing and you do your own thing. And then I loaned Paul Orndorff his championship belt.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. That did happen. You know, I had a belt made by this guy, Mike Botanian in Brooklyn, and we were doing nothing with it. We didn't have any TV tapings or anything like that. And we went down to Puerto Rico, me and Jeff Gaylord a couple of times with Gordon for the AWF and everything, wrestling opposition. And, you know, we were the tag team champions, AWF tag team champions. Orndorff was the world champion. So Orndorff goes, I'm doing a commercial. Did I use the belt? I said, yeah, why not? I said, I don't care. Make your money. You know, the boys, we all look out for each other. And Paul was always nice to me, worked for me for a bunch of shows and stuff, and always a gentleman. So I said, yeah. And I don't know. I think Gordon booked him for something. And I think that he didn't pay him or he canceled on him. And Paul got pissed off and kept the belt. That's the real story, I think.
Yeah. So I wonder where that belt is now. I wonder if Paul Orndorff's family's got it or I wonder if Orndorff chucked it or what.
Maybe he chucked it. Maybe he sold it. His son might have it. I don't know. I mean, I don't have any idea. I never saw the other belts or anything, but I got my UWF belts, the tag team champion and the MGM champion. I still got those.
Oh, that's wild. Yeah. So we've talked about all the, it seems like every time there was one of these new startup promotions that made a run at being a major like UWF, like Global, like AWF, seemed like you were always there. Why do you think that was?
Because I never was a stooge. I got along with everybody. I was a nice guy. I worked well with others. I played well in the sandbox. You know, I think, you know, people know when you're a genuine nice person. It's not, you know, I was ribbing people and, you know, robbing people or stealing from people. I never did drugs.
never pop pills, never would get drunk out of my mind. I mean, I'd have a couple beers, but, you know, I knew my limitations and I would never, you know, miss a flight. I was always early to the arenas. I would always, you know, put people over if I was asked to, or, you know, do the job. But, you know, I looked at the wrestling business as work. This was what my job. This is how I, you know, fed my family. And I saved my money, you know. Nikolai Volkov always told me, and Stan Hansen too, it's not how much money you make, it's how much money you keep.
Yeah.
And that you know, resonated in wrestling too. Johnny Walker, when I was wrestling with Peach State Wrestling and with Southern Championship Wrestling, I must have been on over 100 cards with him, and, you know, when I was up and coming throughout Georgia and stuff. And he would always tell me, in this business, you make it out with only 5 good friends. He goes, you had a good career. He goes, when you retire, you'll know what I'm talking about. He goes, people forget about you. People forget, you know, what you did for them yesterday or today or the day before. They don't even call and check up on you, he goes. But if you have 5 good friends at the end of your career, you did well.
Yeah.
And he was right.
Yeah. And also, during all the... Oh, go ahead. What'd you say?
I said, I got a lot more than 5 friends out of the wrestling business. But, you know, like every... come to New York and they you know, they do autograph shows, they call me up, hey, let's go get some dinner, or let's go have a drink, or you know, let's go you know, do this or that, or meet me here, you know, Marty Jannetty, or you know, like Stan, or I just had dinner with the Nasty Boys, Tony Atlas. I mean, you know, I have good relationships with people. Kevin Sullivan, when he comes into town, I take him out to a nice restaurant by my house, loves it there. So I mean, you know, you treat people good, they treat you better, and that's the way I've always been.
That's right. And also, during all these times and during your career, man, it seemed like you were all over the wrestling magazines. it just seemed like all the time you would see, you know, either a picture or a little something about Sunny Beach. I mean, was that just being out there and being in all these places? I mean, what do you think led all that?
I think it was just being out there. You know, I was wrestling, you know, from Florida, Georgia, Alabama, I mean, all up and down the East Coast, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Maine. I mean, you name it, every weekend I was gone, you know, 3-4 days a week I was doing independent stuff. And they had me on the top, you know, like I'd wrestle King Kong Bundy one night, or I'd wrestle Mick Foley or Lanny Poffo, or, you know, Abdul the Butcher, I mean, down in Florida or Georgia, you know, Bruiser Brody, Southern Championship, be tagging me and Randy Rose, tagged against like Bruiser Brody and Tommy Rich. I mean, you know, it was like they were putting me in with all these names, and the big name guys, I would have good matches with them. And then, you know, I would become a name guy, you know, it was like kind of weird, you know. And then, you know, like Beach and Orton, or, you know, and Tack Mick Foley or Sonny Beach, you know, and the people, you know, started to know my name. And then people would write in, you know, the magazines, oh, we want to see Sonny Beach or Sandy Beach or whatever. And then, you know, it was like, I don't know how I got, you know, into it, but I was one day I was in the World Weekly News, and me and my wife were shopping at like a Key Food over by my house. And when I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and I look in the thing, and I'm on in the World Weekly News, and it says wrestler attacked by women, love craze women or something, you know, they can't get enough of Sandy Beach, you know? And it was like, oh my God, my wife's like, my family sees this, they'll think you're cheating. I said, don't make believe this wrestling stuff. I said, you know, you don't believe everything you read.
Yeah, that paper is more of a work than wrestling is.
Oh, yeah. So I was in that a couple of times. And, you know, I don't even know how I got in there, and whoever made up the story, it was hilarious.
Oh, that's funny.
You know, I did get a good push, a lot of promotions. I mean, I did my job. You know, I was never really squashed. I mean, when I first started out, I used to have to set up the rings. I used to have to tear down the rings. I used to have to get the guys their beers, coolers of beer, you know, drive them places, you know, carrying their bags. That was like an honor. You know, you're walking in with a big name guy and you're carrying his bag for him, and he's walking in signing autographs and you're following him behind him. And, you know, that's how it was. And in Japan, you know, they would have the young boys over there. They would wash the, like, Giant Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta and all those guys, the over guys. They would have the young boys coming up, you know, massaging them and washing them down, bathing them and doing their clothes and laundry for them. I mean, they had like errands and stuff they had to do for them, and to pay their dues and set up the ring and work out with the guys and, you know, cook for them, whatever they did, get their drinks for them.
Yeah. You mentioned All Japan. You worked quite a bit for All Japan and did some things over there too. I know you teamed with Johnny Ace quite a bit over there and doing some runs of things. And what was it like? Was it a different culture shock with the crowds and stuff? Did you notice some of that?
Oh, it was great. I mean, they respect our wrestling over there. It was like we were, I mean, like superstars. Like, you know, like it was night and day from the United States. I mean, they would come up, they would attack you. I mean, I was on the streets of Tokyo. They'd run up and want autographs and come up and touch you. And I was in good shape back then. You know, I was about 6'4", 285 pounds. And I was pretty, you know, jacked up. And they'd come up and they want to feel your arm, or, you know, how to make a muscle form, and they want to take your picture. And then you sign this little like cardboard thing and with your name on it. And people would take us out for dinners and stuff. And me and Johnny Ace, we were there in 91 for the World Tag League Championship. And then they had me wrestling some singles over there a little bit, Isamita and some of the guys. And they put me over quite a bit. And then second trip I went over, they tagged me a lot with Del Wilkes, the Patriot.
Mm-hmm.
And we got over really big, and we wrestled Johnny Ace and Stan Hansen for the Bruiser Brody Memorial Cup over there at the Corican Hall one tour. So I got to wrestle Andre a lot with Giant Baba, me and Johnny, and was in, you know, a few battle royals with Andre and stuff throughout the years. So a couple times, you know, I went out drinking with him, and everything they say about Andre's drinking is true and unsung.
So, yeah, well, in Japan, I mean, well, you know, they have a in Japan, they love, you know, they love American culture. So I imagine this, you know, this blonde haired surfer boy guy coming over there and wrestling must have got over like gangbusters.
Oh yeah, I was getting over so big, and then Johnny Ace was scared for his position, and must be in the truck. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, so I kind of, you know, I went on two tours over there. Then, you know, I guess Johnny was kind of protecting his position over there, so I didn't get to go back. From that's what I heard through the grapevine, but you never know. You hear all kinds of rumors, but I know I did a good job there, and I know I was over. So,
yeah, I remember during that time it was, you know, there's all these large independent shows, right? Because there was a lot of talent, you know, not signed by WWF or WCW. So there was right. A lot of these big mega type shows, right? A lot of independents running with lots of really, I mean, TV caliber talent.
Oh, yeah.
And you were right in that mix. And so that's, you know, I mean, that's, it was a wild time. It's a lot different than what people envision now, because it was, there wasn't such a big steep drop from right. TV talent to, you know, some of the independents, because I mean, there was, you know, a lot of guys that were just, you know, on the independents and that would wind up back on TV soon after.
This thing? But he's on and off. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. That's okay.
Yeah, so can you repeat that last question? Because I had to go.
No, it wasn't really a question. But when you look back on your wrestling career, and, you know, there's the good, there's the bad, what stands out? What jumps out for you? You've talked about a lot of things that you really like, but do you have certain things that really jump out immediately as highlights?
Well, one of my main thing was when I got to wrestle Madison Square Garden. It was September 23rd, 1988. First time I wrestled at the Garden, I wrestled Cowboy Scott Casey. And we went like 20 minutes. Great show. Superstar Billy Graham was doing the commentary with Vince, and you know, they were talking a little smack with me. They said I had a lot of nerve coming into the Garden wearing hot pink, you know, spandex, you know, like pissing off the Garden faithful, you know, in my first debut at MSG. That was one of the big ones. Wrestling at Nassau Coliseum was another big one. Wrestling over in Japan, you know, Corican Hall. I wrestled Dynamite Kid's last match over at Budokan Hall.
Yeah.
Johnny Ace wrestled Johnny Smith and Tommy Bollington, you know, Dynamite.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, supposedly that was his last match, but I think he came back and did another match. But I guess he needed the money. But make a long story short, I mean, it was those were two of the bigger ones. Budokan Hall, I think, and MSG were two really big ones. And then, you know, MGM when we did Blackjack Brawl, but and Beach Brawl, but there wasn't the crowd there. But it was still a pay per view, and yeah. You know, we put over, I mean, I was put over both pay-per-views with the UWF. So I beat Dr. Feelgood, managed by Missy Hyde over at Blackjack Brawl. And then me and Steve Ray Wet n Wild beat Bob Orton Jr. and Cactus Jack, with managed by John Tolis, who was suspended in a shark cage 20 feet above the ring. you know, it's pretty cool. You know, those were some fun times. And then my first match down at Championship Wrestling from Florida, I wrestled a guy by the name of Rip Oliver, the Crippler. Yeah. Rip Oliver.
Yeah.
TV taping. First match, I think it was either 1984 or summer 84 or 85. He's allegedly broke my leg on TV. So I had to get carried out, you know, well, Rip Oliver, you know, I had to stay away from TV for, you know, about 6 months. And, you know, and I learned, you know, I just was kept going to the gym, putting some size on and working out and trying to get better. And then I went up to Georgia and started wrestling some independents up there. There was a TV station in Valdosta, Georgia. A guy by the name of Grady Odom Promotions. He was doing like a Georgia Championship at the time. I think he called it Georgia Championship Wrestling, but it was like, it wasn't like Turner or nothing like that, or Championship Wrestling by from Georgia or something. But he had a TV show, and Ben Masters was like his color commentary guy. And he had the Samoans down there. And back then, Yokozuna, back when he was Rodney, he was going as Kokina, the great Kokina. He was 15 years old. And I wrestled him on TV there. And then Mike Jones, Virgil, back when he was Mike Jones, he was wearing a hockey mask and he was going as a Terminator. And then there was these other guys going as the Scorpions. I forgot their names, but they would wrestle like Tonga Kid or Alpha and Sika. Samu was there a little bit. So they had about four or five Samoans down there. And they had... I guess that I think they were the Timms brothers, Ken Timms and Ed Timms. And then Eric Embry was in and out of there. He lived in Valdosta a little bit. He did a couple of shots down there. So, I mean, I had some really good talent, and it was a great place to learn the business. And we would do little house shows like at National Guard Armories and church, you know, like auditoriums or high school auditoriums down there, outdoor shows. I remember wrestling for Peach State Wrestling. I wrestled Adrian Street with Miss Linda. A big outdoor show, I think in Cordele, Georgia. Americus, Georgia was big. Macon, Georgia, Macon Coliseum. And, you know, all over, we used to do TV tapings at Miss Kitty's up in Atlanta for Southern Championship Wrestling. And Bruiser Brody was there, Abdul the Butcher, Dickie Slater, Colonel Buck Robley, Randy Rose, Dennis Condry, Original Midnight Express. They tagged a lot out of there. Who else was there? Wrestling too. Tony Atlas would come in sometimes. I mean, it was just a great place, you know, and I got to learn from some of the best in the business, you know, and they took time to teach me the right way, you know, and I got to travel up and down the roads with them and hear their stories, and, you know, make some good memories with the guys.
Yeah. During those early days, were you just wrestling as Rick Allen?
Back then I was wrestling as Rick Allen, and I started going to Sandy Beach.
Yeah. Okay.
I wrestled with Rick Allen for about maybe 6 months down to Championship Wrestling from Florida. Young Rick Allen, Gordon Soley would call me. But, you know, it was like Rick Allen wasn't really going too far too quick, and I had a gimmick. So,
yeah.
And I went to high school with Don Curtis's daughter, Lisa Curtis. So Don Curtis helped me, you know, direct me in the right way to, you know, talk to people. And he always told me, get an education. You know, you could always wrestle. He goes, go to college. And I had a lot of offers to play football and stuff, Florida State, Central Florida, Georgia Southern, you know, a lot of big colleges, and I turned them down, and I just went into wrestling because I knew that's what I wanted to do since I was in fifth grade, you know, so it was either be a wrestler or become a policeman.
Yeah. Well, you talked about some of the cons that Tommy Fierro does. Do you still get out there and do appearances at conventions and things when they pop up?
I'm actually probably going to be doing the 80s WrestleCon with them. And I know this weekend they're doing a big event out here in Long Island, a big event. It's in Brentwood, Long Island. I was at the last one. Me and Tony Atlas appeared for Monty and the Pharaoh show.
Oh, yeah.
Monty and the Pharaoh, they're really good guys.
Yep.
They have a really good talk show up here in Long Island. They bring in a lot of big talent. And my company, American Protection, is also a sponsor for their show, too.
Well, so where can people follow you? What's the best way for them to follow you, like on social media stuff, to keep track of, you know, maybe any appearances you're doing and what you're up to?
Well, on Facebook, I have a Sunny Beach page on Facebook.
Okay.
Rick Allen on Facebook, and then my company is APB Security, or APBGuards.com is my website. I think I'm on Instagram too, but I don't really get on there that much. My son helps me do the social media stuff. I'm not really that great at it.
Yeah.
I really spend a lot of time on it either.
Yeah. Well, Sonny, I appreciate you taking the time and coming on chatting to me. This was a fun interview. And
my pleasure, Dave.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, great talking to you, and you know, I'd love to talk to you in the future if you need anything.
Oh, yeah.
Give me a shout, and we'll hook up somewhere down the road.
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, Wrestling Fans International Association is back. That's right, the premier fan club association of the 1970s and 1980s has been revived and is back in business. Join today. It's free at thewfia.org. That's thewfia.org. You can also join us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/WFIA1969.
All right, and welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. Thank you to Sunny Beach for coming on for the interview. Lots of fun chatting with him. We may have him back on again in the future to chat a little more. There's a lot more of his career that we can dive into. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Like I said, we are back weekly, so yay for that. So to make sure you don't ever miss an episode of our back to weekly status, whatever podcast platform you like to listen on and that you're probably listening on right now, make sure you click the subscribe button. And while you're at it, go in there and click that auto download, man. So it's just waiting there for you on the morning of release. If the option is there on that platform to give us a rating and review, please do that. We do hope that you like what you hear and you'll give us a positive review and a 5-star rating. And then also make sure you share the episode, share my social media posts, go out and follow me on all the social media and all those things to really support and help grow the network and keep the podcast plugging along. It is very much appreciated. There's all those links in the show notes, also including links to my Pro Wrestling Tees store. Lots of t-shirts there. That's the best way to financially support the show. So again, thank you for all your guys' support, all your feedback, everything you do for me and for the show. Get out there, support the WFIA, man. Look them up on Facebook. Go to the website. It's all free. Lots of cool things coming up. A virtual convention coming up in the fall. Lots of cool things. You heard the commercial earlier. Go do it, man. You got nothing to lose and everything to gain. So until next week, when we'll be back with another episode with another great interview, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.